From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, we've got a bunch of highlights from our long weekend at the Telluride Film Festival. Then performance artist Tim Miller likes to refer to activist artists as cultural first responders.
The template I really use is how theater and performing artists responded to HIV/AIDS. We actually had cultural formations that were responding first and actually helping steer the governmental and medical response.
And a new documentary details the case against Harvey Weinstein. All that coming up on The Frame. I am just back from the Telluride Film Festival, where The Frame spent Labor Day weekend. While it's certainly not the best-known festival around, Telluride nevertheless has a lineup that's consistently deep in quality and originality. The festival also includes programs that honor actors and filmmakers. I moderated Telluride's tribute to Adam Driver at the Telluride High School. He was at the festival for Noah Baumbach's new movie, Marriage Story.
If we have succeeded, we have a special guest to present this gift to Adam, director Martin Scorsese.
Scorsese directed Driver's 2016 movie, Silence.
What you see before you is a great actor, a great screen presence, truly, gotta say it, one of the finest, if not the finest of his generation. Thank you.
As soon as Scorsese left the stage, I talked with Driver about his collaboration with Noah Baumbach, who made While We're Young and Frances Ha with Driver.
I've worked with Noah four times. There's just something that our way of working, our work ethic is similar in that I just don't take it for granted that we're making a movie. That it has the potential to give language to a culture that's completely different than ours. And someone's paying a lot of money for us to be here right now to do this thing that will last forever. And
one of Telluride's world premieres was The Two Popes. It's a fictional movie about two real people, Pope Benedict and Pope Francis, and it imagines personal and theological conversations between the two pontiffs.
Do you know the Beatles?
Yes, I know who they are.
Of course you do.
Eleanor Rigby.
Who?
Eleanor Rigby.
No, I don't know her.
You know, Yellow Submarine.
Yellow Submarine? That's silly. It's very funny.
Jonathan Pryce plays the current Pope Francis, and he swung by The Frame's condo in Telluride.
When I was first asked to play Pope Francis, I thought, oh, no, this isn't a good idea. Because the day he'd become Pope, the internet was full of images of me next to him. Even one of my sons sent me a text saying, Dad, are you the Pope? So it seemed a bit, am I just being employed because I look a bit like him?
Some Telluride movies have premiered at other festivals, and that includes Pain and Glory, the latest from Spanish director Pedro Almodóvar. The film's star, Antonio Banderas, says the movie is loosely based on a falling out that he had with the filmmaker.
I don't remember what he was talking about, but I remember that he was funny, it was fast.
The actor was discovered by Almodóvar at a young age, but when Banderas decided to make an American adaptation of the Mambo Kings play Songs of Love rather than Almodóvar's next movie, Kika, the director wasn't happy. Banderas told me the story outside next to his hotel room and the hotel's jacuzzi.
To me, he took a picture of Victoria Abril, the actress, himself and me, and he signed behind, the Mambo Kings play very sad songs, Pedro. And he gave me that picture. And then he went away for many years. And listen, I have done good and bad movies in and out of Spain, but I will never, ever step back, no one centimeter, you know, of the things that I have done in my life, because I am content where I am now.
5 years ago, Eddie Redmayne and Felicity Jones starred in The Theory of Everything, playing Stephen Hawking and his wife, Jane. The two actors are now reunited in The Aeronauts. It's a movie inspired by real people about two balloonists in the 1860s. And I asked Redmayne and Jones when they swung by The Frame's condo if they signed onto the project together.
That's a really good question.
I thought you meant flying to Telluride. Yeah. I was like, we did come together, in fact. Initially, we were obviously sent it separately, read it separately, both had a very positive response to it. And then we had we called up on the phone and had a chat about it.
We called each other. We're like, should we do this?
Yeah, exactly. And I think the main thing was, in a sense, was kind of, if you do it, then I'll do it.
Yeah.
That seemed to be the overriding conclusion.
Because this film is basically, a vast amount of it is the two of us in a basket about the size of a sort of small table. And when you're spending 3 months in said basket, you need to really get on with the person that you're doing it with.
And some of the year's most talked about foreign language movies played at Telluride, and that list includes Parasite. It's a Korean movie about a poor family that secretly moves into a rich family's basement and starts to take over their lives. It's directed and written by Bong Joon-ho, who made Okja. Back in May, Parasite won the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival. I talked to Bong at an outdoor theater in Telluride, and he talked about winning the award through his interpreter, Sharon Choi.
한국 영화가 마침 또 100주년이었어요.
So this year marks the 100th anniversary of Korean cinema, and a lot of people discuss this award as a historical gift to celebrate it. And I think it was an incredibly coincidental, amazing gift. But I do think that Korea should have received this award earlier. There have been a lot of amazing Korean film directors, like Kim Ki-young, who directed The Housemaid. And I think relatively compared to Japan and China, Korean films were spread to the Western world a little bit late.
Finally, a lot of really good documentaries premiered at Telluride, including a movie called The Kingmaker. It's by Lauren Greenfield, and it's about Imelda Marcos. And you might think that Marcos has nothing to do with the Philippines anymore, but you'd be very wrong.
Imelda Marcos was back in the Philippines as a congresswoman, which I was kind of amazed at. It was almost as though if we could imagine Nixon coming back and running for office. She had left accused of stealing $5 to $10 billion, left in shame. The United States had a court case against them. People threw them out of the palace, ransacked the palace. But I think nobody realized that they could kind of use the money that hadn't been repatriated to come back to power.
You'll be hearing from those and other Telluride filmmakers in the weeks and months ahead. Coming up next on The Frame, artist, activist, and playwright Tim Miller. Tim Miller is a pioneering queer performance artist, activist, and writer. In the early 1990s, he was part of a quartet of provocative artists known as the NEA 4, whose National Endowment for the Arts grants were vetoed after complaints by members of Congress. Miller co-founded the seminal performance space in Santa Monica known as Highways. It celebrates its 30th anniversary this year. And he has a new book and series of performances called A Body in the O. Miller, who visited our studio just days after the mass shootings in El Paso and Dayton, says that performance artists are well-positioned to be cultural and political first responders. And just a warning, there is a performance excerpt here that includes some explicit language.
I know it's sort of a big attention-grabbing notion, because we don't usually think of theater artists necessarily in that way. But in the introduction to the book, I really talk about in my life and my experience, and even right now, I've already seen performances online from what happened in El Paso. You know, performance friends of mine in Texas have already done events. And in my life, the template I really use is how theater and performing artists responded to HIV/AIDS in the 80s amid the complete hostility of the Reagan-Bush administration that let 100,000 Americans die before Reagan said the word AIDS, that the scientific and health community didn't have anything to help us. What we had was theater and storytelling and performance art. We actually had cultural formations that were responding first and actually helping steer the governmental and medical response. So that's kind of my notion. It's not true of every sort of big social juicy challenge we face, but there's a whole bunch of them where theater artists can weigh in pretty quick.
Early in your career, was it important that you were telling stories that people didn't have access to? They didn't understand those things that you were talking about in a real way?
There's any number of times, even now, when I go to lots and lots of small communities, largely through college and university gigs, bring you in, but you are basically in a rural setting. I know it's the first time they've watched a gay person in a position of authority standing at the front of the theater or the lecture hall talking about what it is to be gay. They might have seen things on their phone or something, but in real time, with the authority of their school, it still really matters. It happens all the time, and people come up to me afterwards and tell me again and again, well, it's the first time I've heard a gay person tell their story.
And there's another aspect of that, which is straight people need to hear what it is like to be hated for the person that you are. And I'm going to ask you to read a passage from your book. It's about where you describe an attack in Bozeman, Montana. I'm not going to say anything more about it. I just would like you to read it.
Two men in a pickup truck with a gun rack in the back pull up next to me. Oh, and I know what's coming. I know what's happening next. It's all so predictable. We don't need to call the Psychic Friends Network. What's coming are some Fs. F***ing faggot fairy freak. Oh, they're predictable, but they're still scary too. F***ing faggot fairy freak. But what follows those Fs is also really predictable too. It could be a rock or a bottle or a piece of concrete. And sure enough, what followed was a half-empty, or depending on your optimistic worldview, half-full bottle of Colt 45 malt liquor. It leaves the passenger side window as it's flung at me. Now, this is not an individual serving of Colt 45 malt liquor. This is a Sunday morning, after church, family-size gallon bottle of Colt 45. It flies through the air, and I admire its perfect geometry, its apogee. I could admire it for a moment even under these circumstances, as it makes a graceful arc and hits me directly on my right hand. My red, red hand, redder now from the hot blood dripping down my fingers. The bottle bounces and shatters at my feet. I look at my bleeding hand. It's not too bad. 5-6 stitches tops. I just hope the guns stay in the gun rack where they belong.
I want to ask you about what you feel when you tell that story.
It's a piece I do a lot. It still carries its sting somehow. It never is completely absent that, partly because my now husband had just been refused entry to the United States. He's in Australia, and we were dealing with all our immigration trouble of before we could get married and get him a green card, and now he's a citizen. But it really reminds me of what was going on that day in my life, that my country had just not let my partner of 14 years enter the United States.
I'm going to play something now that is a performance of one of your pieces by an incredible young man named Kyle Ackerman, who performs a monologue as a high school speech student in Illinois. We found a clip of his performance. Let's listen to Kyle Ackerman.
Anyway, so the airport. I believe the way they phrased it was, I'm sorry, but there is an irregularity in your request for a student visa. It has come to our attention that you have developed significant ties to a U.S. citizen and are a risk for not leaving the country at the end of your studies. Therefore, you are being denied your visa and will be returned home to Sydney on the next plane. I can't breathe. I mean, suddenly I'm stuck in this country that has no air for me. I start thinking back to every time that I've been pushed around by the police, every time that I've had my relationships denied me, every time that a bottle has just been thrown at me, so I just drop my bag and step across the line and I grab Alistair and I pull him in. I love you. That's all that I know. The female security officer at her terminal regards this with annoyance as she glares at us. And as I look into his eyes, she just says, next.
It's, you could Google it, you could find it. It's an incredible performance.
Yeah, he was a senior. We've become friends, and he performs it beautifully. I write about him in my book, and He won the state of Illinois for speech contests for best dramatic interpretation. He performs it really, really beautifully.
Well, what he said is this, because he wrote you a note. I became distraught that in the current state of the world, I too might have a bottle of Colt 45 malt liquor thrown at me from a passing truck like you did. This sort of realization makes you want to do something with whatever tools you have. At the time, the tools I had were a knack for performance and a venue with which to perform. And it's this great idea of this thing that you have created that is your personal story becoming somebody else's personal story. I wonder what it feels like to have somebody else imbue them with that kind of spirit and passion.
Yeah, I write about these young guys in high school who perform my pieces, mostly in speech contests, which is kind of a corner of cultural activity I'm really interested in.
I want to ask you to read something else from the book, and this is where you talk about traveling to places that you might think would be hostile to the message that you're carrying, and that you are surprised by the reaction you get. And I think it's an instructive moment because in some ways you're judging these people based on how they look, just as a lot of people judge others on the basis of how they look.
Yeah, this completely is one of those moments where after you do a little something, you talk to people after the show and they tell you something that's totally surprising. This was in Texas Tech in Lubbock, Texas. Now, here's a real vision of one of these moments. I performed recently during the tour of my show Lay of the Land in Lubbock, Texas at Texas Tech University. Lubbock, so those Lubbock folk constantly tell you with perverse pride, is the second most conservative city in the United States, after Provo, Utah. After my performance at Texas Tech, I found myself surrounded by some ROTC students in full uniform. They just wouldn't leave the theater, and my stereotyping went into overdrive, and I thought they were probably going to beat me up. But then one of them asked me how they, as new military officers, could next year, when they're in active duty, help dismantle Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the law that stopped LGBT people from serving openly in the military, since they were sure our new president would certainly overturn the law, as indeed he did.
So you think you're about to be beaten up, and these guys turn out to be allies who are fighting against a rule that excludes LGBTQ people from serving.
Yeah, it was a gorgeous moment of my own failings being thrown back in my face, and it was a beautiful conversation.
30 years ago, you founded Highways, a performance space in Los Angeles that was willing to stage radical performance and visual art, and I think you recently went back there and performed. What was it like to come back and see that space and think about where the stories that you and your colleagues and allies are telling have gone in those three decades?
It's a real origin point for me. And in this notion of the body and the O, which is Shakespeare's O, which he calls the Globe Theater, the wooden O is this notion of the theater and what we can make happen there. Highways was my best effort to make a wooden O that could really claim the big topics and confront the big issues and tell the important stories as Shakespeare asks us to in that famous little prologue to Henry V. But when I get there, I just feel really pleased and proud that Leo Garcia, the current artistic director, has kept the space, you know, thriving and really there. And it was a beautiful book launch and performance. And it was just really exciting that this, my most crucial O of Highways, is still really pulling people in and changing lives and addressing giant topics, you know, even now at this pretty dark moment in our nation's life.
Tim Miller is the author of A Body in the O, Performances and Stories. Tim, thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, thanks a lot.
And Tim Miller will perform at Cal State LA on September 19th. Coming up on The Frame, a documentary on the women who alleged they were sexually assaulted by Harvey Weinstein. Producer Harvey Weinstein is due in court early next year to face charges of rape and sexual assault against several women. Untouchable is a new documentary that just dropped on Hulu, and it gives voice to some of the women that Weinstein allegedly assaulted. When I was at the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year, I asked its director, Ursula McFarlane, if it was important that her documentary screen in Park City, Utah, because that's where some of Weinstein's assaults allegedly took place.
I mean, obviously, his assaults allegedly took place in many places, New York, Los Angeles. So, you know, you could say that for many theatres in many different towns, London included. But I think there's a special pertinence, poignancy, you might say, about it being shown here. Because, you know, Harvey came to Sundance and he changed it from being this very small festival into something where there was a lot of bidding going on. It became a much more commercial enterprise. So it's a kind of, I sort of feel it's perfect. I feel it's bittersweet because I think a lot of people suffered a lot of pain here with things that happened. But I'm also really pleased. I do think it's a good launch pad.
It has been obviously very difficult for the women who claim they were assaulted by Harvey Weinstein to talk in print interviews. And it's another thing to go on camera mm-hmm. and share their stories, many of which are incredibly harrowing. How did you talk to the people who said they'd been assaulted by Harvey Weinstein about why it was important that they go on camera and tell their stories? Because it's obviously very difficult for them, and we see a lot of people really struggling to tell their stories.
Mm-hmm. I think for many of them, they felt very much part of a movement, a pre-existing movement. They were quite involved in the Me Too campaign and Time's Up and various things. And so they already felt this, even though they knew it was going to be very difficult, they sort of felt for the greater good they needed to do this. There were other people who had not spoken at all before. And I think that was very hard. But I think, again, we had these long conversations about the power of truth, speaking after, in some cases, 40 years. In the case of Hope. And I think they agreed that it was a moment. And, you know, I mean, I was very touched by it because they said, you know, it would be easy for them not to want to speak, but then they wouldn't, you know, they would feel proud of themselves if they did. And, you know, to a person, they've now seen the film. We showed it to all of them. And they're all, I think, really proud they took part.
I'm going to ask you about Zelda Perkins. First of all, who is Zelda Perkins?
So Zelda Perkins was an assistant to Harvey, a sort of personal assistant in Miramax in London.
And Zelda hears of something that happens to one of Zelda's assistants and decides to do what most of the people around Harvey apparently didn't. She says something and she writes something. What happens?
So she goes to Harvey straight away. She's confronted with her young assistant who allegedly has been attacked by Harvey, and he's allegedly tried to rape her, and she's in pieces, and she doesn't want to go to the police, which again is another thing that you know, continually happens. People don't want to go to the police, which I think happens in rape a lot anyway, but she won't go to the police, and Zelda is absolutely up in arms, and she goes and confronts Harvey, and Harvey denies it, and he swears on his children's life.
Which she says is when you know he's lying.
Yeah, because she'd heard that before. So Zelda resigns, but, you know, they want to keep her quiet. So she agrees to sign an NDA. They ask for quite a lot of money, but the NDA is very, very prohibited. I mean, they're not allowed to talk about the incident, obviously, but also they're not allowed to speak to a therapist. And if they do speak to a therapist, the therapist has to sign a confidentiality agreement, which is, for me, absolutely astounding.
And if the therapist breaches the confidentiality of the person who is seeking therapy, that person is responsible for the breach, and that person has to help the Weinstein Company if there's a civil or criminal complaint filed in conjunction with it. That part of the NDA, I have to say, is breathtaking. Not only its scope, but the fact that people who allegedly have been victimized by Harvey can't even talk to a mental health care professional without fear that that might breach the agreement.
I mean, it's astonishing. It's mind-blowing. And actually, Zelda, just a quick aside, has been campaigning since she broke her NDA after the Harvey story came out. She's been campaigning to get these kinds of NDAs banned, you know, to stop people being silenced when they've been alleged victims of sexual or any kind of criminal abuse.
Let me ask you this last question. There have been articles in the New York Times, obviously a big article in the New Yorker. There are future criminal charges, criminal cases, potential civil litigation against Harvey Weinstein. Where do you see your movie Untouchable fitting into all of that? And what do you think it adds to the conversation? What do you hope people take away from it?
Well, I think what we've been able to do in this film is put the allegations against Harvey into a kind of framework of the way that he acquired power. So I hope people will see it as a film of record about, you know, a bigger story about power. Of which sexual abuse is one of the the dark manifestations of that power. In terms of his case, I personally feel that Harvey has really managed in his way to dominate the agenda. And we don't really hear about the women anymore. You know, we hear about the fractures of Me Too and the spats and the rows and the this and the that, which are all very important and intense. But I think the voices of some of the accusers have slightly got lost. I want people to watch this film and go, oh, right, okay. So do you believe them? you know, because obviously Harvey and his lawyers are saying that we shouldn't believe these women. They're making it all up. So I want people to have a look at that and think, okay, what do I really think about this? As well as thinking about the bigger themes and also the themes of complicity and looking at maybe the way things work in their workplace. Do people speak up about this kind of stuff?
Ursula McFarlane is the director of Untouchable. Ursula, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Untouchable is streaming now on Hulu, and that's it for today. Remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You'll find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. We're back here tomorrow at the Moen Broadcast Center.